entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Well, yes, it is. Hello there. Welcome in to the best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. 23rd day of September. Rich Kimble, Carrie Haskell here with you. Downtown brought to you today and every weekday by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. It's our weekly look back at some of our favorite recent conversations. A lot to choose from this week, but we've selected a few that we think will be perfect for you on this Sunday morning. Oh, we'll talk a little Patriots with Christopher Price of Boston Sports Journal. Actress Michael Learned, four-time Emmy Award winner, talks about her work on The Waltons and much more from her long career. Singer-songwriter Jill Sobule discusses her new album with Carrie. The album is Nostalgia Kills. Very interesting conversation there. And we get things rolling this morning with the Money Man. Longtime friend of Downtown, Eddie Money, returned to the show for a seventh time this week to talk about his current tour and the second season of his reality series, Real Money. We're excited to talk to you. This is seven straight summers of you coming on our show, and we thought it's not a summer if we don't get to talk to the Money Man.
Well, Rich, I really appreciate that. It's always great. Congratulations on the success of the show.
Well, let's talk about what's been going on with you. The summer tour continues, and this coming weekend, you'll be in Niagara Falls. Now, don't think about going over a barrel or anything like that.
Well, I don't think about that, but I'll tell you one thing. I'm excited to go to Niagara Falls. Might get a little honeymoon. You never know that, right?
Well, there you go. The biggest news of all for you is that your reality series, Real Money, has been renewed, and not just renewed, but an expanded season of 12 episodes coming up.
Well, you know, the kids are very talented, and Lori looks amazing on TV, and I got a new record coming out. I'm very excited about that, and I'm looking forward. I mean, this guy, Mark Cuban, and Access TV, they've been very good to me and my family, and everybody seems to really love the show. Everywhere I go in the country, people go, I love the TV show.
Well, the show is great, and the show is great because your family is so great, and they're all such terrific people that are fun to watch and that everybody enjoys seeing.
Well, you know what? It's been a lot of fun. I wish we would have done the show like 10 years and 10 pounds ago, but I'm very happy with the success of the show. And, you know, I mean, a lot of great things are happening to me right now. Kids' careers are really taking off. We got the TV show. I got the new record coming out. And now I've got people interested in the Broadway show that I did called Two Tickets to Paradise that we put on in Rochester, New York a couple of times. We put it on in Long Island. I got some interest in that on the Broadway show. So I tell you, I'm all on the dice. I think we're going to have a pretty good year, Rich.
Well, no question about that. You've got the new album out, and Dez has got a new album too, right?
Dez is coming along with his new record. It's going out great to go out with the kids, with Julian on drums and Desmond on guitar. And, of course, Jessica, man, she's a little showstopper out there. She gets out there and doubles all my vocals, and the kids really like her too. She looks great on TV, and she's going to have a record coming out also.
Well, it's exciting times for the family here. So, look, it becomes very clear to us, and you've told us this for years, Eddie, that, man, Lori runs a tight ship, doesn't she, in the Money household?
Well, I tell you the truth, you know, she's from the South, and I could have sworn that we won that war about 150 years ago, but I think I was wrong. You know, she's got that southern streak in her, and she cracks the whip on the boys, but they need it too, you know what I'm saying? To me, I think I'm having a great week when the kids are taking out the garbage and cleaning up the counters, you know?
We're talking with Eddie Money here on Downtown. Hey, what's great about the show is, of course, your family, and for a lot of people, when the kids reach a certain age, they don't want to be around the family anymore. But obviously, there's a lot of love in the family. The kids out on tour with you and still coming around. That's got to feel good after all these years in the business to have your family so close.
You know, that's true, though. But, I'm kind of quirky like my dad. You know, when the kids don't take out the garbage, they don't help my wife do the dishwasher. And we got four boys and a girl at the house, and they're all in the mid-20s. And I just wish, I guess I must be getting grumpy in my old age. But, you know, it's wonderful the kids are in the music business, and it's great that the TV show's doing great. And, you know, just getting a phone call from you, Rich, is really, it's amazing. How's the show going, okay?
Show's going great, although the numbers always spike when the Money Man is on.
I got to tell you, it's been a lot of fun. Well, listen, I got to tell you, I've got a plane to catch, and it's been a great talk. And tell everybody to come down. We're going to do a great show on Niagara Falls, and everybody should go to my website and I find out where I'm playing. And you know me, I'm out there selling T-shirts to the Pets for Vets. They take these homeless dogs, and they, you know, with the tears coming out of their eyes and the chains around them, and they teach them how to take care of these wounded veterans. These Pets for Vets, it's a really great organization. So I'm out there selling T-shirts for the vets and for the pooches, and getting to meet a lot of great people. And it's looking forward to, you know, summer's almost over. We've got a really tight schedule. We've got a lot of shows coming up, and I'm looking forward to having a lot of fun.
That's fantastic. And maybe another pet. Will you be getting another dog for the next season?
I don't know what the good Lord's got planned for me, but I tell you one thing, I'm staying very busy and I'm having a lot of fun.
Well, that's great. Eddie, always a treat for us to talk with you. We look forward to the new season of Real Money, the new album, the Broadway show, and more. Thanks, as always, for visiting with us, Eddie, and best to you and the family.
Rich, you know I love you. Come on, I love the future.
That's Eddie Money here on The Best of Downtown. When we come back right after this, an acting legend, four-time Emmy winner, Michael Learned of the Waltons, next on The Best of Downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's three times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. At 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person, and online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 307-7718. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor. Well, that, of course, the theme from one of the biggest hit shows of the 1970s, The Waltons, which began its long run on CBS in the fall of 1972. One of the stars of that show, actress Michael Learned, went on to win three Emmy Awards for her role as Ma, Olivia Walton, earned another Emmy Award for her role in the early 80s series, Nurse. So we had a chance to talk with Michael Learned just a couple of days ago and look back on her lengthy career in show business. Hard to believe that you recently celebrated the 45th anniversary of the start of the Waltons. In many ways, that seems like yesterday.
I know, until I look in the mirror and I go, oh yeah, 45 years, No, it is so much a part of my life, of my young life, you know. And we're all still so close that it seems like it's just ongoing, even in real life.
Though, do I understand that when the opportunity first presented itself, you were perhaps a little reluctant to give up your stage work for what you might have perceived as a character part in a television show?
I didn't want to do it, no. But I don't know why I even went to see about it. I told my agent I really don't want to do it, even if I get it, which I never thought I would. But luckily, God knew better, or the universe, or whatever. I don't want to offend people if I use the word God nowadays. It can be offensive, but which is a shame. But you know, I really didn't want to do television. I think I was too frightened. And I didn't think I was right for the part because they wanted a woman in her 40s with long red hair, and I had short blonde hair, and I had just turned 32. So I wasn't interested. And then when I got the part, I realized that I was being gifted with something very, very important.
Well, you were so young at the time, there wasn't a great age difference between you and the people who played your kids. Did you still establish some kind of a maternal relationship with them off camera? Was it more of a big sister? What was that relationship like?
I think Mary calls me her sister, Mary McDonough, who played Erin. And so I think in a way it was a little bit of both. I don't think I ever tried to be motherly to them because they had mothers and good mothers. So we were more friend, sister, big sister, little sister, you know, it was that kind of thing. And the youngsters, when Cammie was little, Cammie has never been young. Cammie has always been a wise soul. And, so she never thought of me as her mother in any way, but we were all like a family. I don't know how to describe it, but we were very, very close, and I think that came across on screen.
Absolutely. When Earl Hamner Jr.'s writing was so very good, but were you all surprised at the success of this show and how it touched a nerve with America, this show about Depression-era rural family and here in the midst of the 70s becomes the biggest thing going?
Yeah, it was a shock. None of us expected it. None of us. I thought it was going to be a little TV credit on my resume because I had done television in Canada, but I'd never done television in this country. So we thought it was going to be a little blip and something you could put on your resume and move on. But it was so gratifying, and I look back on it now and I realize it was Earl Hamner. He was a storyteller. And he told wonderful stories about this country and based on his own experiences as a kid. And they still last today. I mean, my granddaughter watches, or did. She's a teenager now, so she's not that interested. But when she was young, she watched it and loved it.
We're talking with Michael Learned here on Downtown. You mentioned the cast has stayed close together. You did a number of reunion shows as well, and those of you still keep in touch, have not only memories of your time on the show, but the friendships have continued to grow over the last four decades or so.
That's why I feel like the show is still going on, because we are so close. You know, I mean, we text back and forth, and I had a little health issue, and I heard from all the kids, every single one called to see how I was doing or texted me or... So I feel like we've been gifted this second family, all of us, and with no baggage. You know?
The best kind of family, then.
Without all the trauma that real families have, you know.
When you come out of such a successful role as this, I'm sure there's always the concern that you might get typecast, but you flip that right on its head with a great role in a series that I loved and I think was underappreciated. A terrific show you did with Robert Reed, Nurse. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I really feel sad that show didn't go. I think we had a lot of trouble in the beginning getting writers to write for New York. They had scenes where my character would come home and soak in her hot tub. My character, who lived in an apartment in Harlem, who is a nurse, and there was one scene I remember where she's going through, she might have to have a hysterectomy, and they had her going through this terrible depression and throw away her little satin bedroom slippers with pom-poms on them, And, you know, so there was a lot of trouble in the beginning. And both Robert and I really wanted New York writers because we felt that L.A. writers weren't really connected to the New York scene. And so I think I pissed CBS off. I didn't work for 10 years after it, but I think it was a good show. And when we got New York writers involved, I thought there was great potential.
You've also
disappointed that it was canceled.
Oh, I agree with you there. You've done a lot of work in daytime dramas as well, and we've talked to so many actors who have experience in doing those, and that's a different kind of work than doing episodic television, because you're always dealing with last-minute rewrites and script changes. But I have to think, as an actor, that really tests your mettle.
Oh, boy, does it ever. I mean, I have so much respect for those actors, and they're so good. And they're learning pages of dialogue every night. You know, they put in a full day of work, and then they go home and learn 3 pages of dialogue for the next day. They're amazing. They're amazing. They don't get the credit they deserve.
I enjoyed your run as well on Scrubs. Was it fun to get out there and show off your comedy chops?
That was fun. I had a good time doing that show, and they were wonderfully kind and welcoming. You know, I think we weren't always so great on the Waltons when the guest star would come on, because we knew each other so well. We'd be kidding around, and before a shot, we were completely relaxed. And then sometimes we'd get into the giggles or something, and the poor guest star was a nervous wreck and was trying to get a decent rehearsal before the shot. And I think we were very naughty sometimes. But they weren't like that on Scrubs. They were very professional and very welcoming, and it was a nice memory.
Driving Miss Daisy, that's a play that you've appeared in multiple productions of over the years, and you're currently preparing for a run of it at the Laguna Playhouse with the wonderful actor Lance Nichols. What draws you to that role to have gone back to it?
Well, it's a wonderful play, and it works like gangbusters. It has everything. It's poignant, it's funny, it's about unconscious bias, it's a classic, I think, and it reminds me of my grandmother and her relationship with a man named Ambrose Lewis, who supposedly worked for her, but really was her best friend, and possibly her lover. But he was the only person in my childhood that I absolutely relied on. Drove me to the hospital from Connecticut when I was pregnant, when I was in labor with my first child. And he was the first person through the police doors when I ran away from home. And, you know, Ambrose was just, if Ambrose said he was going to be somewhere, he was somewhere. He was there. Mm. And so whenever I do that play, he's very much with me, as is my grandmother.
When you do stage work, is there anything in film or television that can match that immediacy and that response of a live audience?
No, there isn't anything like it. And when it's working, it's magic. And when it isn't working, it's a nightmare. And you know right away when the audience starts coughing and shuffling that you've lost them. And then you try to get them back, and that makes it worse. But when it's working, it's there are moments where the hair has stood up on the back of my neck when the theater is so silent, and you know that you're all in this moment, this magical bubble together, and it's wonderful.
Well, we wish you well in that. Now, before we let you go, do you think there's any chance I could get you to reprise your role as Olivia for just a moment? If I said, if I were to say goodnight, Ma, do you think you could say goodnight, Rich Kimball?
I think I could manage it. Right. You'll have to pay me a lot of money, though.
All right. Well, I'll get the checks in the mail.
No, I'll do it for you for free.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm going to give it a try here. Goodnight, Ma.
Goodnight, Rich Kimball.
My day is made. Michael, it's a real treat for us to talk with you. Thank you so much for making time for us, and we wish you much luck in the production of Driving Miss Daisy, good health, and everything that goes with it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for making it easy.
That's Michael Lerner of the Waltons, and so much more. Really fun to talk with her here on Downtown, the Best Of Show for your Sunday morning. Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell here with you, and when we come back, singer-songwriter Jill Sobule discusses her career and her newest album, Nostalgia Kills.
Hey friends, Rex, Sparky, and Fiona here from Green Acres Kennel Shop in Bangor.
You may not know this, but being a talking pet carries a lot of responsibility.
You said it, Fiona. It's up to us to give voice to all pets who don't have a voice of their own. Right, Rex?
Right, Sparky. And what we'd like to say on behalf of all dogs and cats is thank you.
Once again this year, pet owners from all over have voted Green Acres Kennel Shop the area's best kennel, best pet store, best pet groomer, and best dog trainer, according to Market Surveys of America.
Thanks to Don, Paula, and the staff at Green Acres for making it such a great place for dogs like me and Rex to come stay, play, and learn.
And for cats like me to get the best quality food and care.
But most of all, thanks to you pet owners for putting your confidence and loyalty in Green Acres Kennel Shop year after year.
I guess when Green Acres Kennel Shop wins, we all win.
Yeah!
Hooray! Woo-hoo!
Green Acres Kennel Shop, 1653 Union Street, Bangor. Online at greenacreskennel.com.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, our home away from home.
Downtown Orono has a new pub and eatery, the Common Loon Public House. The Common Loon is a casual, relaxed place for great food, drink, and company in the heart of the village, and the perfect spot for a proper pint and a hearty or healthy meal. Open 7 days a week with lunch on Thursday and Friday and breakfast on the weekends, the Common Loon Public House features an eclectic menu with influences from over the ocean and close to home, serving up favorites for lunch and dinner like fish and chips, poutine, and pub burgers. Don't miss Wing Night Wednesdays, live music Fridays, and weekend mornings. The menu features hard-to-find dishes such as a full English or Irish breakfast. We're also home to the only wood-fired brick oven in town and offer a variety of pizzas and British pasties. Enjoy a selection of imported beers, local brews, and signature cocktails. Happy hour specials 3 to 5 and after 9 every night. The Common Loon Public House is the place to be for EPL matches, international rugby, the Sox pennant race, Patriots, Bruins, and Black Bears. If you follow it, they can show it on their 7 HD screens. 36 Main Street in downtown Orono, the Common Loon Public House is the place to visit before, during, and after the game.
Penobscot Theater Company presents...
Mrs. Robinson...
Sexy and sardonic.
You are trying to seduce me.
A boozy cocktail of comic drama.
Aren't you?
The main premiere of The Graduate.
Aren't you?
September 6th through the 23rd at Bangor's historic Opera House. Tickets at 942-3333, penobscottheater.org.
Plastics.
Lost my keys, I lost my heart, lost my car in the parking lot, lost my voice but can hear sing from the Island of Lost Things.
Island of Lost Things, that's a track from the terrific new album by singer-songwriter Jill Sobule called Nostalgia Kills. Carrie, you've been a fan of Jill's music for a long, long time. A very talented artist, and as you found out in your conversation, a terrific person to talk to as well.
Yeah, she's followed her since the early 90s with her very first album, and she was a joy.
Here she is, Jill Sobule, talking to Carrie here on The Best of Downtown.
This album just has some wonderful songs on it, starting right out of the gate with a song that just had a glowing write-up in Billboard earlier this week, I Don't Want to Wake Up. For those that may not have seen the article, can you talk about the genesis of that song?
Oh, my gosh. Well, where do I begin with this one? First of all, I want to say that I don't believe at all that you have to suffer for your art or you have to be in a bad place to write a good song. Not at all. That saying, it was just after a really bad breakdown. And I have to say, sometimes it gets those juices flowing. And I was in the, staying with a friend's couch, and it was not the best time. And a friend, at the same time, I was reading the historical Jesus History of God, Karen Armstrong's. So I had all this kind of Old Testament stories and allegories going around in my head. That mixed in with a friend said, why don't I give you a little bit of my chocolate with mushrooms in it? So there was the beginning of that song.
Well,
the first time and the last time that I ever wrote a song under any kind of influence. And you know what? It wasn't bad.
No, the results of the Old Testament and mushroom-dosed brownies came up with a really, really great song. I know.
Now what do I do? Well, the last time I had done mushrooms was in junior high school, going to see Alice Cooper's Billion Dollar Baby show live in Denver.
Yeah, I don't imagine the results were quite as productive for that time as they were for this one.
It wasn't productive, but it was the most amazing show I ever saw in my life. Also, back then, you're like, smoke machines. How do they do that?
There's a great video that pairs up with I Don't Want to Wake Up that used footage from, I was reading in the article, an old anti-drug movie. So how did the idea to use that footage on this song come about?
Well, I go in the rabbit hole I can spend hours Googling one thing and then 5 hours later, and somehow I was on silent images of dreams in silent movies, which there was some of that, and then anti-drug movies from the 60s, and there was this crazy, whacked, strange, animated, half-animated, half-real Alice in Wonderland anti-drug clip or movie. And it was one of those that I'm not sure if you saw it back then, you'd be like, you know what? I want to do these drugs, or else it would have scared you to pieces. It was probably a combination between the two. So my friend Joshua does these amazing videos of found footage, and we had to find out if these were public domain, and they were. So he took them and created this wonderful, beautiful, strange video that seems to somehow be the right soundtrack.
Yeah, the video fits the music as well as anything that I've seen in a long, long time. It was another song on the album that really caught my attention was I Put My Headphones On. I think that experience of those big headphones that covered your, you know, just completely covered your ears and blocked out everything around you is an experience that a lot of kids of the 70s and 80s are going to really attach to. I clearly remember doing just that, just sitting and having the headphones on and sort of blocking out the world.
And there's something more special than earbuds, those big cans that would cover half your face. It felt like you were more lost in it. There was something, like you had a beautiful big machine on your head and that would transform you. That song was really thinking about as a kid in that same junior high school period of first of all, I was really glad that I had a brother that was 6 years older than me that had really good taste in music. So I was really into my brother's music as opposed to maybe the teeny bopper stuff that my friends were listening to. And I was an odd kid who didn't have that many friends, and I wanted to go home and just listen to my music, or I wanted to watch the Watergate trial. Two things. But yeah, it's kind of the song is both a kind of vision and narrative of what it was like to be kind of feeling like an outcast teen, at the same time a celebration of music that I listened to and how that basically helped and saved me.
It's funny, my brother was 7 years older than I am, so I had that same part of it too, where I sort of skipped the music that all my friends was listening to a large extent, and was pulling out his 8 tracks and popping those into the stereo with the headphones, and that's the music I was listening to.
Yeah, we had the cooler stuff.
Now, another song that's been getting a good amount of attention early on is Island of Lost Things. It was a pick of the week selection with Rolling Stone earlier this summer. That's again, and I keep saying it, and I seem to be repeating myself, but another just amazing song on this album for you.
Oh, that might be one of my favorite lyrics on the record. And it began again. It was one of the later songs. I wrote it, I think, a week into recording. And at first, I started writing a list of things. I'm very forgetful, and when I'm stressed, you know, every hotel has an item of mine somewhere. And I'm always, you know, I asked my mother, do you think I've got early really early Alzheimer's or a tumor in my head? I keep losing my phone. And she's like, honey, you've been that way since you were out of my womb. You know? But I was making a list of all the things that I lost and all the things that are missing, and thinking about this, you know, this strange island or place where our, you know, the missing sock is, the missing keys. And then it started changing and evolving into things that I've lost, people I've lost in my lives, situations, towns I've lost, and it started getting confidence I've lost, and it became a whole other beast.
Your songs do that. There's the meaning that it starts with, the meaning that's sort of the superficial meaning, but so much more gets woven into it as the song progresses. It, definitely on this album, but in your music in general, that seems to be the way that your songs develop, and that's part of the appeal of your music.
Yeah, I mean, I try to think of myself as a storyteller. I was doing a songwriting workshop, and I'm sure it was different than other writers where they talk about the, you know, verse versus chorus, when to put in a bridge, and I think usually, not always, but I like to write from the very first word. I don't have a chorus. I'm just writing a story, and I like it to have kind of a beginning, a middle, and an end, and sometimes there's a little twist in there. So, and I think maybe on those headphones, some of my brother's albums were influences, some of the artists in that style of writing.
We're talking with singer-songwriter Jill Sobule here on Downtown, and the album Nostalgia Kills released on Friday. People think of a nemesis as being a bad thing. In your case, having one led to a pretty good song. The song Almost Great, spurred on by a run-in you had with someone at an industry, and I'm assuming now that's a music and not steel industry event.
You know it. Oh, yeah, it was at a party, and it was kind of a music industry. It was kind of a hipster thing in L.A., and I remember there were these three dudes talking, and one was saying, yeah, you know what? It's true that, like, people over 40 can't really write. They can't write pertinent songs anymore in music. And, maybe, you know, it's a young people's game. And I remember going up and saying, you're an idiot, and walking off. And he didn't know who I was. But that guy, ever since, has been my nemesis. I don't remember what he looks like. I don't know. But he is my nemesis. And I love having, everyone should have a nemesis that really doesn't matter, or they don't know. And the nemesis doesn't know that they're the nemesis. But that guy is my nemesis. And he kind of spurned on that song and gave me a little oomph of like, I'll show you.
Now, most of the album is original stuff you wrote. You did include a couple of covers as bonus tracks, and one is a beautifully stripped down version of the 70s Ooh Child. You also have a great cover of Warren Zevon's Don't Let Us Get Sick. Now, you toured with Zevon a few times over the years. The fan recorded duets of you and Warren doing Going Down to Jackson and I Kissed a Girl, by the way, are two of my favorite tracks on my phone's playlist. They work so well, even though they're not great recordings. They're just the enthusiasm and the joy of the songs. Your time spent touring with Warren, did that have an influence on your music or the way you wrote or anything like that?
Well, yes, I think it pushed me to become a better writer, better lyricist. Like, he was one of those writers that, a literary writer, he was one of those that I wanted to write like that. And he was one of my lyrical heroes. So to be open up for him and to have him, to know that he's listening to you, it's like, you better be on your game. You've got to be on your game. And he was so, you know, there's a lot of things about Warren, you know, I mean, he was a bad boy. But with me, he was so kind and so generous and funny. And we had an unexpected, beautiful, beautiful relationship. And I miss him really so much. And I'm here's one thing, too, that I think about him is, oh, for my friggin' nemesis is, oh, yeah, that they're, you know, people like their earlier albums were so much better, and then they got lazier as they got older. His lyrics, to me, got even better. Like, his those last two records, slay me. So, there. It makes you feel like you can't get lazy. You still got to push.
I've always thought that being a fan of Zevon's stuff and then your stuff, there is a that storytelling aspect of both of you have in your music. Just the imagery of the words, or the imagery created by the words, is so vibrant. And that's what makes your stuff on this new album so appealing.
Thank you so much.
Moving away from the songs a little bit, this is a crowdsourced album. I feel like I should do the disclaimer that all the news people have to do when they're talking about a book that their company is part of. I was part of the Kickstarter and have
yay.
You had some other people that were pretty well, let's say a bit more well known than I did. Fred Savage of the Wonder Years. Tom Bergeron was part of the crowdsourcing for this. I love this one. Your cousin Neil, who used to be your babysitter and also happened to be the creator of Law and Order of SVU.
Yes, when he created it, and he was there for many years, and then the last 4 or 5 years he left and has done other things. But I remember going up. I get to go up and hang out with Ice-T and take pictures of myself on the slab where all the corpses were.
And then the top donor, the one that got the title.
It's a joke. It's a total joke.
Joss Whedon. Well,
as Joss Whedon is my personal Lord and Savior. And at the top tier of what you could donate was for a certain amount of money. And I thought it was a complete, you know, it was a complete joke. Who's going to do it? I will put on my record and say that you are my personal Lord and Savior. So Joss Whedon is my personal Lord and Savior.
Well,
the creator of Buffy. There you go.
That's hilarious. Now, this album, it feels like an album and not just a collection of songs. Like, you know, some music today, I think it's a part of the digital. You know, many albums just feel like a bunch of individual songs. Was that something, that thematic part of it, was that something that you had in mind going in as you were developing this?
Well, you know, I have to give credit to Ben Lee, who was the producer. I gave him, like, so many songs, and he was overwhelmed, and I go, what songs do you want to make for this record? And he picked the kind of more contemplative, I won't say darker, but not as topical or goofy. And he picked these songs that did feel like a book of short stories. It doesn't feel like a bunch of songs or singles. It feels like there is a thematic sequence to it. And I have to give it to Ben for doing that, actually.
For me, a lot of the album felt like, you know, endings being a way to lead to change or to lead to new things. That was...
Yeah, I mean, the title track, Nostalgia Kills, really is, I mean, the album, you were saying, Headphones, Looking Back. Some of these songs are on this, I'm doing theatrical piece, a one-woman show called Hashtag F Word Seventh Grade. I'm not sure what I can say on your show, but it's a look back, but it's also a warning that, you know, let's look at it and watch it today, but let's put it away and move on, because, you know, the nostalgia kills, you know, we have to keep moving or die. That's the chorus of that.
Yeah, I feel like I could talk about Nostalgia Kills with you all day, but you don't have the time for it, and we're probably going to run out of time as well. I do want to touch on a couple of your other projects. Now, on this album, you don't really reach into politics at all, but you have been known to. Your company is called Pinko Records. In 2016, you spearheaded a collaborative album of protest songs called Monster Protest Jams, and that was a great album. What was that experience like of gathering songs created for a cause from so many talented songwriters and singers and musicians?
Oh, yeah. And I think because in the last years, and this was before, I started doing this 2 years before the election. So I'm also friends with a lot of artists and songwriters who are activists, from Wayne Kramer, who has Jail Guitar Doors. I've played many of the prisons that he goes to, from Boots Riley to Steve Earle. So there's a community of old-timey act, like in the old days, the Woody Guthrie.
Yeah.
There's an activist community. So it was easy to get all those people together because I knew them. And it's interesting that this, before this record, and I had other ones, And Ben didn't chose the political ones. And I thought, this record, I had to do this record, because the last couple of years, I'd been really involved writing topical and political songs. Mm. And we'll continue. I think this had to be a personal record.
Now, outside of the albums and stuff, you're do a lot of work, stage stuff. You've had a musical, Prozac and the Platypus. You did soundtrack work on the TV show Unfabulous, working on a new staging of Yentl, going back to the original book as the source material. You're have worked on a musical called Times Square, looking at New York City in the 70s, the Jill and Julia Show, a collaboration with Julia Sweeney. And you mentioned earlier the current stage project you're working on, the one-woman show F Seventh Grade. Since your music has such a strong storytelling component to it, do these types of projects feel like a natural extension of what you do with your music, or is it something different?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And it's a really good time for it, too. It's now the theater world is in the last years is more open to non-traditional musical theater music. Mm. So you don't have to have jazz hands going on in all your music. So it seems like being a storyteller, it feels like a natural place to go. Plus, I can procrastinate. And when you're doing a project, I mean, I procrastinated doing this record for years, but when you're in collaboration in the theater, you have someone that says, hey, we need a song for this scene, you know, and we need it tomorrow. And I like that.
Yeah, the deadlines help force it along a little bit.
I like deadlines, yeah.
Now, before we finish up, I do have to mention what I find to be one of the funniest songs in your repertoire. Something I think you did it. It was just an in-studio appearance. It's called Slutty Halloween, which it contains the hilarious line for me, and a skimpy black dress is not very scary unless you're Ann Coulter.
Oh, yeah. That was an aside, but the idea of the song was, you know what? I love Halloween, and I hate that women, and it's not a prudish thing, I hate when it's just like the quote-unquote slutty costumes, unless it's really well done. Like if you're, that you've got a really amazing vampire outfit. It's a sexy vampire outfit. It's not just like a little miniskirt and you put horns on. No.
Right,
that's
yeah.
So that one, I had to put in the ankles, I think. So, you know, just wearing, you know, horns and a skinny black dress isn't good unless, you know, you're pretending, you know, the scariest vampirist that of them all, Ann Coulter, who said some pretty ridiculous things the last 2 days, actually.
Yeah, it's a lack of imagination. You know, that's the problem, is that, you know, you just got to put a little more effort.
And so, I like scary costumes. Come on.
But any more songs for musically neglected holidays in the works? Or?
You know, well, you know, I have written, and Harry Shearer, you know, from Spinal Tap is every he does these Christmas shows every year for the last 15 years, and he always includes my holiday classic, Jesus with a Dreidel Spinner.
Yes. I've tried to encourage people here to play it, but I haven't got anybody to play it on the air yet.
I will say
our sister station, the classic rock station down the hall, does a bunch of holiday songs, and your version of Merry Christmas from the Family gets a lot of airplay and a lot of listener requests every single
That's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, that gets a lot of airplay in December on WKIT. So,
fantastic.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much, and what a nice conversation. And it's always a pleasure when you have interviews with people that it doesn't feel like interviews, it feels like a conversation, and they know their stuff. So thank you.
That's Jill Sobule, the new album called Nostalgia Kills. It's the Best of Downtown when we return. We'll talk a little football, Patriots and the Lions tonight from Detroit. Christopher Price of Boston Sports Journal breaks it down next on The Best of Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
Thinking of making home improvements to increase efficiency? Well, there's no time like the present. And the people at Penobscot Home Performance want you to know that efficiency main rebates have increased from $700 to $1,000 per zone as of May 1st. Also, anyone with Bangor Gas can get rebates for $2,000 per insulation zone up to $5,000. Call to get your free home energy audit at 469-6100 or visit PenobscotHomePerformance.com. And we're back on the Best of Downtown, your Sunday morning. It's game 3 for the New England Patriots this week as they take on old friend Matt Patricia and the Detroit Lions. We got the lowdown on the game just a couple of days ago from our friend Christopher Price of Boston Sports Journal. Let's start with the big news of the week, the Josh Gordon acquisition. Desperation move or a stroke of brilliance?
I think it's a little bit more of the former than the latter, at least at this point, at least until we see Josh Gordon on the field doing things that we saw maybe from him in 2013. If we see the 2013 version of Josh Gordon, then you could call it a stroke of brilliance. But right now, I think it's probably more of an act of desperation of a team that really needs a boundary presence, or as you know, at least we saw over the course of the first two games, is sorely in need of a boundary presence. This is a team that really has struggled to connect when it comes to the deep ball over the first two games. They've struggled to really get any sort of offensive traction, at least in the passing game. And look, a lot of that's going to be rectified when, you know, Julian Edelman comes back after week four. But, you know, in the meantime, you need as many capable folks as you can. And Josh Gordon, again, if he's, you know, the head is screwed on straight and, you know, he's doing everything that he should be doing, it could be one of those guys. So we'll see.
And I look back to last weekend of the game with Jacksonville. If it's possible for a guy to go 24 for 35 for 324 yards and two touchdowns and still feel empty, that's kind of what it felt like with those numbers from Tom Brady.
Yeah, it did. Look, Brady, we've talked any number of times about his brilliance, and he remains one of the best, if not the best, to ever play the game. But yeah, I think that's a pretty fair statement, a pretty fair way of looking at it. When you consider the outcome of what happened on Sunday against the Jaguars, those numbers do look a little bit empty, you know, for lack of a better term. So, look, they need someone to break things up a little bit, you know, to kind of I heard a colleague of mine use this analogy a little bit earlier in the week. It's like, you know, it's playing a game of pool. It just kind of shake things up a little bit. You know, you need to kind of spread the table. And Josh Gordon might be that kind of guy who is capable of spreading the table. We'll see. You know, his track record is spotty, at least over the last couple of years, to be generous. But if he, again, is a guy who can come in here and buy into the program and be the kind of guy they think he's capable of being, you know, he might be, you know, he might be a positive contributor in the long run.
Let's talk about some of the injuries. Some good news. It sounds like Cyrus Jones will be back. Because of that, does that mean we're less likely to see Patrick Chung on Sunday?
Yeah, I think that tells you, I don't want to say all you need to know about Patrick Chung's history, or not his history, but his injury situation. He was not at practice Wednesday. He was not at practice today. And history, you know, tells us that if a guy is not at practice on Thursday, chances are good he is not going to play in the game on Sunday. Patrick Chung and Trey Flowers were both missing today with concussions. And so I imagine they want to kind of, you know, treat those with as much care as possible, at least going forward. So I wouldn't look for either Chung or Flowers to be playing this week for New England.
We're talking with Christopher Price of Boston Sports Journal. Well, let's take a look at that Lions offense. We know very well what LeGarrette Blount can do, but the tough thing, the challenge for the Patriots, you've written, will be to stop that pass game, led, of course, by Matthew Stafford, a terrific receiver in Golden Tate. And as you've written, this is very much a vertical as opposed to a horizontal passing game.
Yeah, and that's not to say that, you know, Golden Tate isn't a vertical receiver, but he's more of a catch-and-run guy. Very, very dangerous with the ball in his hands, very, very dangerous with the ball in open space. And so he really kind of fills that role. He's one of the best. You run down a list of guys each year in the NFL, the truly special wide receivers, and he is consistently an underrated presence. And I think we're going to see that on Sunday. That the guys who really have popped to me over the first two games, after rewatching, you know, those first two Detroit Lions games over and over again, are Galladay, a big physical receiver who knows how to use his body, as well as Marvin Jones. And, you know, Jones is more of the, you know, the vertical presence, the traditional deep ball threat. There's a lot of different guys in that passing game to account for, and it's all led by Stafford, a guy who Bill said the other day is one of the best downfield throwers in the game. So Patriots pass defense is going to have its hands full. The run defense, you know, you look at that Detroit running game, it's not so great, honestly. You know, and we all know and love LeGarrette Blount, but they've had trouble moving the ball on the ground the first two games. So the focus on Sunday is going to be about containing that aerial attack. And so a lot of that is obviously going to fall on the shoulders of that secondary.
Will they play aggressively, or will they tend against an offense like this to sit back a little bit?
I think they're going to sit back a little bit for a couple of reasons, not the least of which they're not going to have Trey Flowers. And, you know, from what we've seen over the first two games, you know, he's the guy who moves that passing attack. And so if you don't have Trey Flowers and you have a more of a pass-based offense, I say, you know, you come out, you run a lot of nickel, maybe even a little bit of dime, and you flood the middle of the field and you make it as hard as possible for a guy like Stafford to connect with those guys. So I wouldn't put it past the Patriots to dial up some pressure on occasion, but I would expect more of a conservative approach, at least when it comes to getting after the quarterback this time around.
So who has to have a good game defensively for the Patriots?
Boy, that's a good question. I'm going to put it on the shoulders of the secondary. We know Gilmore has played very well over the first two games, but you know there's been a drop off both at safety and the rest of the cornerbacks. You know the first two contests of the season. You're going to need to see a good game. Is Eric Rowe capable of a bounce back after getting benched in Jacksonville? Can J.C. Jackson or Keon Crossan assert themselves at the cornerback position? Is Jason McCourty going to end up playing, you know, cornerback or safety? There's a lot of questions there, and I think a lot of it is on their shoulders, at least at this point, when you're talking about trying to slow down that Detroit passing game.
On the defensive side of things, the Lions have done a good job of getting to the quarterback. 8 sacks through the first two games. They've got a tough defensive tackle in Williams. Kennard out there at the linebacker is a terrific pass rusher. What's going to be the biggest challenge for the Patriots' offensive line?
Rich, you hit it right on the head, is containing that pass rush. If there's one thing that they do well, that front seven of Detroit does well, it's getting after the passer. They have another couple of guys over there, including Ziggy Ansah when he's healthy. He can be an absolute handful to deal with. It's about giving Brady time. I'm not saying that we're going to see a lot of deep balls, but, you know, we're going to see some of that quick passing stuff that we've seen really over the first two games for Brady. It's not so much of a deep ball attack, but, you know, getting the ball out as fast as possible. James White, Philip Dorsett, Chris Hogan. You're not going to see Brady hold on to the ball all that long because, again, they do have that difficult pass rush. The one thing, if you're New England, though, that Detroit run defense is not that good. You know, I'll bottom line it for you here. It's not that good. This would be, at least on paper, a game to see an awful lot of Sony Michel. This presents itself as a possible breakout game for the rookie. So we shall see. But I'd expect to see a lot of running for New England, especially if it gets that lead early, they want to control the clock.
Well, yeah, and that's what I was going to ask, too. Is it important for them to establish that run with that notion that the best defense is keeping your offense out there on the field?
Yeah, you know, that's a perfect point, Rich. It really is when you talk about this game, because you want to be able to control the clock. You want to be able to control the momentum every time out, but it's especially the case when you talk about a quick strike offense like Detroit. So this, at least to me, strikes me the kind of game where you try and get that lead early with a little bit of quick passing. You know, you maneuver down the field, you lean on guys like James White, Rob Gronkowski, Chris Hogan, those types of options in the passing game. Then you get that double-digit lead in the second half, and you hit them with a heavy dose of the run game, which should be, you know, the plan, because, again, that Detroit run defense has been pretty substandard this year.
Matt Patricia off to a rough start as a head coach of the Detroit Lions. Does he need this game more than the Patriots do?
You know, that's a great question. And I talked to an NFC scout for a story that should be going up either tonight or tomorrow for Boston Sports Journal. The thing that you like if you're a Lions fan is the second half of that game last week against the Niners, where they fell behind early and they were in a real hole. And you started to think, well, you know what? This team has already given up on Matt Patricia. Second half, there was a lot of fight in that group. And I thought that really bodes well for down the road. Not saying that they have a shot here going into this. Well, of course they have a shot, but I mean, it's you look at this game on paper, and it should be a New England win, but I think Patricia is okay if they continue to show that level of commitment that they showed in the second half of that 49ers game. They're building something that's just going to take a little bit of time, a little bit longer maybe than we anticipated, but based on what we saw in the third and fourth quarter against the Niners, it looks like at least initially they're headed in the right direction.
Is this Patriots team a vastly different team when Julian Edelman comes back?
Yeah, it really is. I tweeted this out, Rich, the other day, and I think it's really important to remember the Patriots have not had Edelman, Gronkowski, James White, and Tom Brady together on the field at the same time since November 27th, 2016. Now, I don't expect Julian Edelman to come back and all of a sudden catch 10 passes for 100 yards and be the kind of guy that we saw at the end of the 2016 season, for example. But this is a guy who makes the offense go. This is a guy who moves the chains. This is a guy who has a great connection with Tom Brady. I'm not saying it's going to, you know, erase all of the difficulties or some of the difficulties that this offense, you know, has to deal with on occasion. But it certainly will give them a jolt. They'll be pointed in the right direction once again. I firmly believe that when Edelman comes back.
Boston sports journalist Christopher Price talking Patriots and Lions as we wrap up the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. Thanks to Chris, the Money Man, Eddie Money, wonderful actress Michael Learned, and singer-songwriter Jill Soule. Thanks to all of them, and thanks to you for making us a part of your Sunday morning. Hope the rest of your weekend goes well. Join us tomorrow on the program. Actress Perry Gilpin, Roz Doyle from Frasier, helps us celebrate the 25th anniversary of Frasier's debut. Plus, Maine Black Bear football coach Joe Harris-Simiak, movie reviews from Alan Adams of The Maine Edge, and the latest on the Sox and the Patriots as well. That's Downtown. We'll see you tomorrow at 4 right here on Z62. You're gonna be all-